Sai Ram, dear listeners, this is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, welcoming you all to yet another episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth. On the show, the questions come from you listeners. They may be on practical situations you face in life, certain doubts you may have with regards to Swami's message, or a question that arises from the desire to know what Swami has said in a certain context. And we all know I merely deliver the answers, but the answers are always and shall always be from Swami and Swami alone. So let us begin by offering our most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. I mentioned it in the morning today, I will repeat it now. If any of you were to come and take a walk around the ashram now, you will just be surprised by the variety of people you see. There are a number of people from non-English speaking countries, Westerners on one hand, and there is a group of about 1,100 villagers from some of the most economically backward tribal villages in the Anantagiri district of Andhra Pradesh. There are devotees, young and old, rich and poor, from different professions, and may I also add, different approaches to spirituality itself. And they're all found here in the ashram. But all are equally drawn to Swami. Yes, it is because Swami has a persona that is irresistible and draws one and all, and there's no doubt about that. But it also shows how universal Swami's message is. We could be intellectual, highly educated, or unlettered, living in modern comforts or in thatched huts on the slopes of a hill. Swami's message is still applicable to us. So there is no problem or confusion that you and I can ever come across in life for which Swami's message cannot offer a solution. We only have to look deep, look within, and once we find the solution, apply it in our lives. Well, as always, we have an interesting question on this week's show too, which gives us an opportunity to explore one important aspect of Swami's message. But again, as always, before we get to the question, let me share with all of you a very beautiful quote that I happened to come across. This quote has a short background to it. In the year 1904, a publication called the Brown Book Magazine conducted a contest in the United States. The contest was one had to describe what is success in 100 words or less. And the entry that won the award was by Mrs. Bessie Anderson Stanley, who later went on to become a very famous writer too. In that piece which won the award is the quote for this week on today's show. So here it goes, the words of Mrs. Bessie Anderson Stanley. I quote, "He has achieved success who has lived well, laughed often, and loved much. Who has enjoyed the trust of pure women, the respect of intelligent men, and the love of little children. Who has filled his niche and accomplished his task. Who has never lacked appreciation of earth's beauty or failed to express it. Who has left the world better than he found it, whether an improved poppy, a perfect poem, or a rescued soul. Who has always looked for the best in others and given them the best he had. Whose life was an inspiration, whose memory a benediction." End of quote. I don't know about you, but I'm fascinated with this crisp answer of what is it to be successful. I guess each one of us need to ask ourselves if we can claim to have achieved what this quote describes as true success. Have we laughed often and loved much? Have we won the trust and respect of people? People who are pure and intelligent. Especially if you are a man, ask yourself, if you have won the trust of pure women, then you have been pure yourself. And most importantly, do children find you lovable? They should not merely fear you, but should be able to love you. Then you know the art of being simple and innocent yourself. The next line is brilliant too. Let us ask ourselves, have we filled our niche? We don't have to achieve great things, transform the entire world, or resolve international conflicts to be successful. Each of us have a role to play, a small space in the lives of those around us to fill. Have we filled that niche and played that role to perfection? That is the question we need to ask ourselves. A successful person is one who has not missed an opportunity to appreciate the beauty in the nature around. How very, very significant is that? As they say, you are not alive if you walk into a garden and do not see what you see, do not smell what you smell, hear what you hear, and be where you are. If all our success in pursuit of success has taken away our ability to relish the beauty in nature, what is the worth of that success at all? If we cannot live in the moment, we can never leave that moment better than it was. In the pursuit of making our future more beautiful, we leave behind many, many such small moments in our life as they were, unrelished and also unimproved. We are successful when we are able to leave behind as many moments better than they were when we entered them. They need not, again, be big accomplishments. As the writer puts it beautifully, it could be a flower cared for, a poem that gave a moment of happiness to someone, or even giving comfort to a person in pain or depression. Can we build our success story with as many such little moments? Well, but let's be honest, the world has its flaws too, right? But we don't have to add to them at least. Are we ready to find our own flaws and weed them out so that every day the world sees a better version of me? Can we strive to give the world the best of ourselves and be a person who looks for and highlights the good in others? We are successful if others feel their own goodness in our presence, not if we assert our greatness and make others feel small, isn't it? And she ends with two phrases that are just too good, the icing on the cake, so to say. Can we lead our life in such a manner that our every living moment was an inspiration to someone, and once we leave, a mere thought of us feels like a blessing? Well, we all must have come across people like that in our life, isn't it? When we set out for an important task, if we happen to bump into them, we feel, oh, it is such a good omen, I saw this person. Can we live in such a manner that we are that person for someone? And when we do, when people recollect our memories when we are no more, they will feel auspicious, inspired and blessed. Let us ask ourselves, is this success beyond us? Does this success require degrees, a mighty bank balance or a social influence? If we can be successful this way, I'm certain that Swami will look at us and say with pride brimming in his eyes, he is mine, she is mine. Because to be successful in this way, all that one needs is pure love in the heart. So dear listeners, before we head to the question, permit me to read those beautiful words written by Mrs. Bessie Anderson Stanley one more time. I quote, "He has achieved success who has lived well, laughed often, and loved much. Who has enjoyed the trust of pure women, the respect of intelligent men, and the love of little children. Who has filled his niche and accomplished his task. Who has never lacked appreciation of earth's beauty or failed to express it. Who has left the world better than he found it, whether an improved poppy, a perfect poem, or a rescued soul. Who has always looked for the best in others and given them the best he had, whose life was an inspiration, whose memory a benediction." Well, time now to head to the question for this week. Well, this question is from a very, very regular listener. She very regularly writes feedback to our other programs, so I'm very happy to have a question from her. And more importantly, the question is in the voice of the person who has sent us the question. So I'm going to play out the question for you. It's an interesting one. As I said, it gives us an opportunity to explore another beautiful aspect of Swami's message. So let's first listen to the question from the in the voice of the questioner herself.
Sairam Brother Prem, my name is Purnima Srinath. I have been following this interesting program and I appreciate the wonderful research that you undertake to reply the questions posted on this program. This prompted me to get some detailed explanation with regards to different meditation techniques. Does Swami want us to follow only light meditation? Has he ever spoken about practicing of Kundalini meditation? I have read Swami disapproving transcendental meditation. Please clarify if my understanding is right. was thumb meditation given by Swami? Because I have heard this from Dr. Srikant Sola's talks. And I sincerely tried it in the past, but it stopped me from practicing Namasmarana, as one should not chant or think of anything while doing thumb meditation. Kindly throw some light into the queries I have raised. Jai Sai Ram.
Thank you, Sister Purnima, for that question. As you could make out, the question is about meditation, the different techniques of meditation. More precisely, does Swami want us to follow only light meditation, a technique which Swami has himself spoken about extensively? And the other question is, has Swami ever spoken about Kundalini meditation, which is a very, very popular phrase, of popular technique, Kundalini meditation? And she's also making a reference to what we refer to as transcendental meditation. There are a few occasions where Swami has spoken about transcendental meditation and in a sense disapprovingly. So that is one thing. Is that so? And there's a reference to something called the thumb meditation, which is spoken by Dr. Srikant Sola, one of our doctors in the hospital and who also runs workshops on meditation. So this is a meditation which he often speaks about, the thumb meditation. So she's making a reference to that. And more importantly, what is Swami's take on all of these things? Has Swami encouraged these things? Has Swami spoken about that? So it's an interesting question on meditation. I think I have spoken a couple of times on the topic of meditation, especially one where a person had asked that I've learned the technique of meditation from a guru and I've come to Swami. So is it all right if I start thinking of Swami during my meditation and not my guru? And there was a question, I think, of that sort, where I had the opportunity to speak about meditation. Many of the points which I could repeat in the answer to this query are in that answer, which I think I will not, I'll try as much as possible not to repeat that, because even if not asked for, my answers are always quite detailed. And Sister Purnima Srinath has asked for a detailed answer, so you know that the answer is going to be definitely detailed. So I'll try to skip as much as possible those parts of the answer which probably is there in that answer which I gave to that person about meditation. I would encourage people who are interested in this topic to go and listen to that. And coming to the question here, Swami taught light meditation. Well, there is a reason why Swami spoke about light meditation. In fact, that is one of the, I think, one of the very few techniques where Swami has literally taught us step by step. How do you do that light meditation? How you, how is the procedure of the light meditation followed? Literally, you know, step by step counseling Swami has given that. So why did Swami speak about light meditation? Does Swami discourage all other forms of meditation? Right, that's the other question. We'll probably start with that. Does Swami really discourage other forms of meditation, be it transcendental meditation? You have Kundalini meditation, as it was mentioned. Then there is Hatha Yoga, Raja Yoga, and I'm sure there are plenty of names and they're all a mouthful. I don't even know them all to list them out here. So there are many, many things like this. So does that mean that Swami discourages the practice of all of these meditations? All I can say is there is a context to this. When Swami speaks a little discouragingly about some of these techniques, especially let's start with transcendental meditation, right? You're right that a couple of times Swami, whenever he speaks about meditation, Swami specifically mentions transcendental meditation and he says that how it is quite a ridiculous idea as such. And that's what I'll try to explain to you. The reason is, you know, the idea or the concept that transcendence can be achieved through a very simple meditation technique is something which Swami disapproves of. So it's not like Swami does not like the idea of transcendental meditation, but the idea that you can transcend this body and the senses, you can reach that state of transcendence or trance, as it is shortly called, just by doing a few minutes of meditation, Swami says that's ridiculous, right? We lead our lives, we have our desires, we have our passions, we have our ambitions, we chase our dreams, we lead a comfortable life, we have our luxuries. With all of this, if we sit and meditate for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, or even 30 minutes, or 1 hour a day, Swami asked, do you think that you can get that transcendence by this act of meditating for a few minutes of a day? And that is the idea that Swami does not approve of. And whenever Swami speaks of this, Swami will say, then do you think that it was for no reason the rishis and the sages of the past actually sat for tens of hundreds of years trying to achieve the state of trance? If it is so easy, then why would you have these legends of the Saptarishis meditating for hundreds of years and thousands of years? And Swami would say, even now if you go to the Himalayas, there are sadhus who are doing tapas for decades and decades together and still have not reached that point. And Swami says, do you think that you can reach that state merely by doing this meditation? That idea, which is marketed, transcendental meditation, and you can achieve trance through this simple act of meditation, I think that is the idea Swami disapproves. I'm not, again, saying that the people who are talking of a technique like that are selling that idea. I really don't know from where they come from. But as receivers of a technique like this, if I am going to go out and start practicing, maybe many of us have this misconception in our mind that transcendental meditation helps me transcend my body. Swami says that's not so. Just because it has the name transcendental, just by doing that simple technique of meditation, you're not going to get that trance. And when Swami speaks of this, he'll often say this, you know, is it so difficult to give up body attachment? Because when you talk of transcendence, you're talking about transcending body consciousness, right? So Swami would say, is it so difficult to give up this body consciousness? It's actually very simple. Swami says that if you have two bottles of wine, you will give up your body consciousness. And that's so true, right? You know, you can drug yourself to give up body consciousness. You can drink yourself to give up body consciousness. Swami says that's not the whole point. Even as this body consciousness leaves us, even as we transcend this body consciousness, Swami says you have to acquire atmic consciousness. As the dehabhimanam is given up, atmabhimanam has to be acquired. Swami says that is the important thing. So yes, you can sit in meditation and probably through your deep concentration reach a state where you for a few moments at least transcend the body, transcend the limitations of the body and senses. Yes, you can achieve that, but that is only going beyond body consciousness. It does not take you to the state of atmic consciousness or atmabhimanam. And Swami says that is where, you know, it falls short. And when talking about meditation and Swami's guidance about meditation, I think there is this story. I again would have mentioned this story in another context, I'm sure. It's about a student who very, very sincerely wanted to practice Jyoti meditation, right? Swami has spoken so much about it, which we'll come to a little later, where you light a candle, you sit in front of the candle, you look at it and you start meditating on the flame. Then you close your eyes and imagine the light within. And there's a huge technique to that. I think there are discourses on that. You could go and look up that. So this boy wanted to try this particular technique of meditation. And, you know, we all have these ideas that when we start doing meditation, these are the kind of experiences that we must have, that, you know, you should see an effulgence inside. There will be a certain energy raising in our body. And I think it comes from the various literature we read, I guess. So this boy also had all of these ideas, and you know, he was so first of all interested in trying to practice this technique that Swami has taught, and he was also thinking that he will probably get an experience like that, some spiritual experience that probably you can note down in a diary and speak about later. We're all interested in something like that happening to us, isn't it? So this boy says that, you know, he does this for many, many months. He's been very diligently goes to a secluded spot and sits early in the morning and does this meditation. And he says that that experience never happened. So he was striving for that. So he says one day when he's sitting and he's doing meditation, you know, oftentimes because it's an open space, it's a expansive space, the candle would flicker because of the breeze blowing through. So he had taken the hard cover of a notebook, and he had placed it around the candle so that it doesn't flicker because of the wind. And one day he was sitting like this in front of this contraption and he was doing his meditation. What happens is, he says that experience started happening because he felt that the light was actually becoming brighter and brighter, and it was becoming warmer, and he could feel the energy is raising, and he said, wow, I'm finally having that experience. Then eventually he finds that the heat is becoming a little too much for a spiritual experience maybe. And then he looks in front of him and he sees that the cardboard has tipped over the candle. The that is caught fire, and a few other things which were around, all of that is caught fire, and there's this huge conflagration in front of him, and that's all the warmth and the light that he's feeling. So, I mean, that's an embarrassing thing to happen to you, so he silently puts the whole thing aside and he leaves. And I think a couple of days later, or the next day, Swami comes up to him, and Swami makes a reference to this, you know, how is your jyoti meditation going on, or something like that. And then Swami tells him, you know, if you keep looking at a candle like that, you'll become mad. You'll not get any spiritual experience. Swami says, you don't have the knack, so you'll become a crack. You know, that's the joke which Swami cracks when referring to this incident. This boy is very thrilled because Swami is making a reference to an incident which he did all by himself. Nobody else knew about it. Nobody else was informed about it. So he was very thrilled. But what followed was the most beautiful explanation that Swami gave, and that's the most important thing. Swami says, you know, you're talking about meditation. Meditation, the word which you use is dhyana, right? And what is the culmination of meditation? Why do we do meditation? We reach a state of samadhi, right? When you talk about trance, you're referring to a state of samadhi, where the mind is absolutely still and it cannot be disturbed by anything external. So Swami is saying that when you talk about dhyana, you're talking about dhyana leading to samadhi. And Swami went on to explain that, do you realize that dhyana and samadhi are the penultimate and the ultimate stages of what we call the Ashtanga Yoga of Patanjali, which is the eightfold yoga, the eight-step process of yoga. And Swami said that, you know, you cannot start at this point, which is like the highest point. You know, dhyana is the highest. You can't take to that particular step without going through the first six steps. And what are the first six steps? They are yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, and dharana, dhyana, and samadhi, Swami says. And again, I've spoken about this before. This niyama, yama, and niyama are actually leading a life of righteousness and discipline. Yama is all disciplines which relate to our association with people in society, and niyama are personal discipline, our personal cleanliness, our personal rules and regulations that we keep for ourselves. So this yama and niyama, Swami said, this is the basis, this is the foundation, right? Without this being laid firmly, you cannot go beyond. And the stage of pratyahara, Swami says, where all the senses are withdrawn within. And then the three stage, what we refer to as meditation, is actually dharana, dhyana, and samadhi, where concentration and the act of trying to meditate upon something, and then samadhi, where the meditator and the one he is meditating upon and the act of meditation, all three merge to form samadhi. So Swami says that three final steps is what we refer to as meditation, and that cannot be attained unless yama and niyama is firmly placed. So Swami says, you forget about all the meditation and all that. Concentrate on this yama and niyama first. Lead a good life. Lead a disciplined life. And when each one of them, yama and niyama, has again 5 points within, which talks about what are the disciplines which come under them, which are nothing but what Swami speaks of on other occasions as good living. You know, be good, see good, do good, sealing on desires, and all of that is what constitutes yama and niyama, how you speak to others in your everyday interaction with them, speaking softly, speaking pleasingly, speaking truth, not hurting anybody in thought, word, or deed. All of these constitute yama and niyama. And Swami says, you have not yet perfected this, then when you start trying to leapfrog to the last three stages of dharana, dhyana, and samadhi, it's not going to happen so easily, right? So does that mean that the act of practicing meditation is wrong, or, you know, that we cannot even imagine practicing meditation unless all of these stages are done? It's not so. The complete effectiveness of meditation will never come unless these initial stages of what we refer to as the Ashtanga Yoga are satisfied, right? But still, you know, the practice of meditation can be useful even before we cross yama, niyama, pratyahara, and the other stages, right? As Swami would say, when you meditate, forget the samadhi part. You know, samadhi is the ultimate, right? When you really get there, the samadhi, the nirvikalpa, savikalpa, or whatever it is, all of that comes much later. But meditation itself Swami says has, you know, three stages of concentration, contemplation and meditation. Swami says, so one thing which Swami would often say is, most of the people who claim to be meditating are only trying to concentrate. Some people go into the stage of contemplation, but hardly anybody reaches that state of meditation, because when we go into that state of true meditation, we won't know how many hours we have sat in meditation. We will not know, we will forget completely who is meditating upon what, and the whole scenario just vanishes into oneness. So that meditation, Swami says, that hardly anybody does that. You're either doing concentration or contemplation. So Swami says that when we practice meditation, the idea of sitting in one place and sitting calmly and trying to control the mind and trying to streamline our thoughts, Swami says that is nothing but concentration, and that will help you in everyday life, right? That will always be of use to you. So that part of meditation will be applicable to anybody, right? So that is why it does not require that we master all of these stages and only then we have to sit and do meditation. Even for this idea of calming the mind, to be able to concentrate, I think that is important. We'll come to that, why that is such an important thing even for all of us, right? But what we have to understand is, when we talk of meditation as a path, you know, there is one basic difference that we have to keep always in mind, that it is one thing to use the technique of meditation in our everyday life, and it's a completely different thing to take to the path of meditation. These are two different approaches by themselves. The act of meditation, using it for our whatever our daily activities, is one thing, but when we talk of the path of meditation, if you're saying that dhyana marga, I'm going to take the path of meditation, that's a completely different idea. And this confusion of the two is what Swami would often point out to and would say that you need to be careful about, right? You know, let's take a very, very mundane person who's probably lost in his regular life. You know, let's say a good person, I'm not talking about anything else, who's lost in his work life, in his family life, and what he has to do on an everyday basis. Right? Even to such a person who's probably not initiated into spirituality, who's not thinking about spirituality, who's not thinking beyond what he needs to do at that moment for his making his ends meet, even if such a person was to take to the path of meditation, take to the technique of meditation, let me correct that, take to the technique of meditation, he or she will benefit, right? Because as I said, meditation's first stage is about concentration. And anybody, you don't have to be spiritual, you don't have to be a believer of God, you don't have to be a devotee, you don't have to be an aspirant, a mumukshu, you just have to be somebody who needs concentration. And who does not need concentration? All of us need concentration, right? So anybody who practices this technique of meditation will benefit. And, you know, that's why nowadays you have, you have your mobile applications which can teach you meditation. You have guided meditation apps. Because to reach that state of concentration is quite easy. You could have even an inanimate application on your phone guide you to do that, right? But when you talk about serious forms of meditation, when you're talking about taking to the path of meditation, that's where I think it becomes much, much more specific. When you're talking about things like Hatha Yoga or Kundalini Yoga, these are very, very specific techniques, and these have very pointed and dedicated goals in mind when you're trying to take to these. It's not merely about concentration, it's not merely about trying to calm your mind and be peaceful. It's much, much more than that. They are very, very specific sciences, right? And that is why Swami does not approve of people very casually taking to these merely by reading books or, you know, just listening from some friend or somebody, and, you know, whom you feel that, okay, this person is very well versed in Kundalini Yoga, I learn from him. Swami discourages that, because these are not like normal meditation techniques which we can learn from a book or from a mobile application. These are very, very specified and very pointed paths which need to be taken to very carefully. And Swami would often say this, if you do mistakes in this, if you do mistakes in this path, the pitfalls are very deep, the repercussions are very, very scary. In fact, that is why I was once speaking to one of the old students. he was saying that when he was a student, I think this must be in the 80s, there were a couple of boys who had taken to the practice of Kundalini Yoga and probably even some advanced techniques of Pranayama Yoga also. And Swami was informed about it. Swami always knew about it. And apparently Swami had made a special trip to the hostel to speak to the boys in general, literally discouraging them from some of these techniques, because without having a proper guide, it is very dangerous. It's not only non-beneficial, but it is positively dangerous to take to these techniques. For example, let me, probably something which you could relate to, you know, in this program, many times when I'm talking about, when I'm in the process of answering some questions, I make references to neuroscience, I speak about hormones in the brain, and, you know, I had an occasion to speak about depression, and I spoke about the mechanism in the brain, and then spoke about the limbic system, the frontal lobes, prefrontals. See, all of this information is actually available on the internet, right? And it doesn't take much of an effort to go and read these things and gather that information and make that information part of my understanding. And why do I do that? When I answer a question, the basic answer to that question is based on Swami's explanations and Swami's message. But to literally bolster my argument, to make my argument more effective, I can pick up information such as this, which is easily available, which I don't need to spend much time to grasp and understand. I can use this information and try to enhance my explanation using them, right? But that does not mean, just because I know a little bit of information regarding the brain and neuroscience, I cannot become a neurosurgeon, right? When you talk about surgery, that's a completely different technique altogether, which calls for mastery of so many things. If I wish to become a brain surgeon, the decision should have been made much, much long back. At least in India, it's like that. When you're in 10th standard, you should have decided the appropriate subjects. You should have written the appropriate exams. You should have taken to medicine. And after medicine, the master's should be about neuroscience. And then you study surgery. You need all of that before you can specialize in that technique of what the brain, either doing research or doing surgery to the brain. The information which I have right now, which I speak, is not good enough, right? Same is the case with something like Kundalini Yoga and all of these fancy names which we come across. Swami says that these are all specific techniques. These are not open for all. Just like how you want to be a neurosurgeon, you have to negate a lot of things, right? You have to give up the other studies and you have to pick this and you have to concentrate on this. Some of these techniques are like that. Kundalini Yoga and all are not for people who are leading regular lives. There is a lot of prescribed discipline that need to be maintained. Discipline with regards to food, discipline with regards to the times you wake up, the number of hours you sleep, and all of that. That is why Swami says that, you know, don't take to this unless there is a real serious aptitude for that. And that's why I'm saying it's not that nobody should practice this, and as devotees we should never talk of some of these techniques and we should never venture into them. I think if we really have that calling and aptitude for that, I'm sure Swami will guide us in an individual level to that. But in general, Swami does not encourage this, as we are going to come to in a short while, why Swami not only encourages them, but Swami to an extent actively discourages them also. There's more reason to that, just not because everybody is not cut out to it. There is another reason to that, and of course we'll be coming to that in a bit. So why Swami did not encourage us to take to this path of meditation, right? It's not that Swami did not want us to meditate. In fact, Swami has spoken about it extensively. Swami has written an entire Vahini on that. The Dhyana Vahini is about that. And I think in the 9-point code of conduct also somewhere, Swami mentions meditation as an important aspect of a devotee's life. So it's not that Swami discourages meditation, but the path of meditation, to take up to dhyana, to take up to the idea of tapas, sitting and, you know, withdrawing yourself from the society and the things around and doing meditation. Before I come to the meditation part, I'd like to share something which I read long time ago. This is not from Swami's literature, but I read this from another source, where this person speaks about the devotion of Radha, right? And we all know this part of the story of Radha, in fact, the other Gopikas too, when oftentimes, after Krishna has left their presence and Krishna has gone away to Mathura, they would be doing work and suddenly they would hear the sound of the flute. They would hear the flute, the beautiful melody of the flute, and they would think that Krishna has come, and they would run to the banks of Yamuna. And when they reach there, they would see that there's nobody there, and they would think that, oh God, minds are playing pranks on us, and we're imagining things. And this would happen many, many times, especially to a devotee like Radha. So many times in a day, she would, you know, wake up with a jerk and say that I'm hearing Krishna's flute and run to the banks of Yamuna. Apparently, you know, when you take to some of these techniques of Kundalini Yoga and some of these advanced meditation techniques, there are many experiences one goes through. And these are pretty much like indications to the individual that the progress is happening maybe. You know, there are certain visions that you get, there are certain sensations in the body that you feel, certain pains in the body that you feel, and certain kind of dreams and visions, as I said. So one of the person who was talking about this Kundalini Yoga, where I read this thing, he says that in some of the very, very advanced stages of Kundalini Yoga, one of the signs that you are progressing, or one of the signs that you are there, is the ability or the spontaneous sound of instruments such as flute being heard in the mind, right? So this is an experience that people who take up to Kundalini Yoga have, apparently, that they hear the sound of the melody of the flute in their head. And he says that the Gopikas and Radha and the devotees of Krishna had, through their devotion, had reached such a state that the greatest yogic practitioners reach after years and years, and in fact decades and hundreds of years of practice of these yoga, when they start listening to the sound of the flute. But because they associated the sound of the flute with always with Krishna, they did not realize that this was a spiritual experience of a very, very extraordinary kind that they were having. They thought it was their Krishna and they would run to the banks of the Yamuna, right? And the reason why I am mentioning this is the love for God, the amount of spiritual progress that can give is unequaled, right? That is what Swami says. When you have devotion, when you have that kind of bhakti, the kind of bhakti that the Gopikas had, the kind of bhakti that Radha had, the kind of bhakti that Meera had, when you have that kind of a devotion, the progress that you make is phenomenal, and it is literally incomparable to any of these other techniques. And when I talk about loving God, to have that bhakti for God, honestly speaking, that is not available for everybody in the world. It is not as good as certain other ambitions. I think there are more people who have spiritual ambitions rather than that kind of a personal love with God, right? We all worship, you know, India is a land of temples. We all go to a temple, we all worship God, and either it is out of fear or it is out of desire. But not all of us have the ability to relate to God, right? But when God comes down as an avatar, when God is in our midst as an avatar, that opportunity is what precisely gets intensified. You know, it's available for so many more people when God comes down as an avatar. When God is in a human form, He's relatable. When you get this idea that I can pray and He will hear, I can offer Him something and He will accept, I can do something for Him and He will be pleased by it. These are ideas you don't get unless you really have that kind of a personal interaction with God. Yes, many devotees do have that. Just like how I spoke about Meera, there are so many other devotees, Surdas and Tukaram. But for most of us, that is a stage an opportunity which is beyond our grasp, which comes to our grasp when God comes down as an avatar. And this is not so only when Swami is in a physical frame. Even now, even devotees who come now, you when you listen to stories of Swami and Swami's love and Swami's grace, you know that, yes, God is there, God does listen to you. You know, God can be loved. God can be loved like how you love your mother. God can be loved like how you love your spouse. And that idea that God can be loved is available for so many people and so easily when an avatar comes. And now putting this in line with what I spoke about Radha, you know, that is the opportunity which is available. when God comes down in a human form, the opportunity that is available is to take to the path of devotion, to constantly keep Him in your mind, to dedicate all your actions to Him, to love Him without seeking anything in return. That opportunity actually puts you much, much ahead of any of the other paths. So it's almost like that, you know, when we are in Swami's presence, when we have this opportunity to relate to Swami as our personal deity and literally on a day-to-day basis build this loving relationship, that opportunity is like, you know, you're standing in a huge queue and you're probably three or four people behind the counter where you're going to buy the thing. And at that point, you say, no, I'll go back right behind the queue and I'll start the last part of the queue and I'll start back. You know, that is what it is when you turn to the path of meditation or Kundalini Yoga or Transcendental Meditation or all of this. You are right there. You need to just take a few steps. You have that opportunity. And when you have that opportunity, if you say, no, I will take to this path, I mean, that's probably the most absurd thing to do. And that's why Swami discourages it. Swami is saying, I'm giving you a path which is far more easier. You are far more ahead of all of these people and I'm giving you this opportunity just because I have come in a human form. And that is why, more than anything else, that was the most important reason Swami discouraged the idea of taking to some of these serious paths of meditation. They're not invalid. It's not that they do not have relevance. I mean, people practice it even today. There are many, many people who progress spiritually through this. But the ability you get when God comes into your life in a human form, in a relatable form, you're able to love Swami, you're able to do things for Swami, you are able to lead a life purely thinking that I want to please Swami. You know, that is more than enough for me. I'm not bothered about what I earn. I'm not bothered about who is happy with me. I just want to please Swami, right? That opportunity is so rare, and that is why Swami speaks about this. And we are clearly at an advantage given the situation we are in life, and that is one of the reasons. Now, probably I'll go into a little bit of detail about what is the role that devotion plays in what is it that meditation gives you that devotion can give you in a better way or in a more easier manner, right? When we talk about yoga, Swami would often say this, you know, you talk about all these different kinds of yogas with fancy names. But basically, what is yoga? Swami says yoga is nothing but chitta vritti nirodhaka. Yoga chitta vritti nirodhaka is what is the statement which I think comes in Patanjali Yoga only. Where he says yoga is nothing but the ability to calm the mind, the ability to keep the mind stilled. The mind is always pulled with so many ideas, and to keep the mind calm is the whole process of yoga, right? And Swami would explain, I think this was again an explanation that Swami gave to a devotee, where he says that what happens when you try to meditate? When you sit in a place and you close your eyes, you are trying to concentrate on one thought, right? So what happens? You have these many, many thoughts coming into your mind, especially when you don't want thoughts, more of them flood your mind. Swami says, where do these thoughts come from? These thoughts arise out of desires, right? Swami says, in your wakeful state, when you are going about your everyday activity, your mind is constantly coming in touch with different objects, different scenarios, different people, and all of these become desires in the mind. Either you want something or you don't want something. Either you want something to happen or you are wishing that something does not happen to you. You want to be in someone's company or you want to run away from someone's company. All of these are nothing but desires, either positive desires or negative desires. Good desires, noble desires, legitimate desires, and bad desires, cruel desires. But all are different forms of desires. And Swami says, these form thoughts, and these are the ones which keep hitting you like the wave lashes at the beach when you're trying to do meditation, right? When this meditation, this act of meditation, Swami says, is inspired by love for God, love for God is also a form of a desire. That's what Swami says. When you say, I'm loving Swami, that is also a form of a desire, and that desire gets purified. You know, when Swami was physically amongst us, where we could see Swami and Swami could speak to us, the desires would always be like, Swami, come to where I'm sitting. Swami, look at me. Swami, take my letter. But nevertheless, that was born out of devotion. That was born out of love. But slowly that that desire gets purified, and to a point where you start telling, Swami, I just want to please you, Swami, I just want to lead my life the way Swami will be happy with it. So that it is all different types of desires, and Swami says when meditation is inspired by love for God, these many desires slowly start getting replaced by this one desire, desire for God, right? And this happens much, much more easily because it is based on love, and love is a very strong emotion, right? When I'm sitting and I'm thinking of some inanimate object, or I'm thinking about meditating on a mantra which I do not emote with, which I do not have an emotional connect with, it is very, very difficult because you're struggling against the mind. But when it comes to love for God, love is a spontaneous feeling, and love is a very, very strong emotion. And Swami says that this replacement of these many thoughts which are born out of desires with this one thought which is again born out of a desire, that is the desire to love God, Swami says happens more spontaneously and more easily when there is devotion, right? So in the place of many desires, in this process, one exists, right? And that is nothing but concentration. That is the state of concentration which we talk about, right? And as I said, concentration is has these three aspects of concentration, contemplation, and meditation. The other thing which Swami refers to is there is a form of meditation that we do every day that we do not realize. That we, without meditation, we cannot do anything in life. That's what Swami says. And what is that? A very simple example which Swami gives is, let's say that you're eating food. There's a plate in front of you, you're eating food. That process of eating, we don't realize we're doing it so unconsciously and, you know, so inadvertently now that we don't realize. When you're eating that food, Swami says that you're looking at the plate. There are some things which can be eaten. There are some things which cannot be eaten, like probably a chili or something else which is not edible. It just adds the flavor. So Swami says that your mind, your eyes look at it. Then your mind says, no, this should not be eaten. So your hand puts it aside. And then there is this food which can be eaten. So the mind says, it discriminates and says, yes, this can be eaten. And it is taken, and, you know, the process of eating. So Swami says, what is happening is, there is a coordination between the mind, the senses, and what we refer to as the karmendriyas. The jnanendriyas and karmendriyas are in sync. The discrimination of the mind, the senses, and the hands are in sync. Swami says, this is what meditation is. The ability to do in that moment what has to be done through the coordination of the intellect, the senses, and the body. Swami says that is all is meditation. And when we talk about sitting still, when you're talking about meditation in that sense, that's all we are doing. At that moment, the body is still, we are trying to still the mind, and when we are able to keep the mind, the body, and the senses in line, in coordination, that's what we call meditation. And Swami says that is something that you do every day in life in different activities. But the sad thing is, as Swami says, we are not able to do it as much as we are supposed to do it, or we must be doing it, right? And that's the whole problem. And why does that happen? It's because we have multiple focuses in our life, right? When we're trying to do something, we know that, let's say I'm trying to read a book, or I'm trying to prepare for an exam. I know what I'm supposed to do. I know I'm supposed to sit there, look at my book, try to understand what I'm reading, to absorb it. But there are these multiple things which are literally crying for my focus, right? There's probably a phone ringing, there's probably a television running in the other room, or someone is calling. Or in my own mind, there are these many thoughts which are arising. So there are multiple focuses, and I am not able to apply that idea of meditation at that point purely because the mind is not one-pointed. It has got these multiple things which is trying to catch attention at the same time, right? So when we talk about, let's talk about anything starting from one point and reaching another point. And let's talk about a journey that I want to start at this point and reach another point, or it could be any activity. I want to achieve something. I want to accomplish something. There is a starting point. There is an ending point. And in between, there is the amount of time it takes to reach that goal of ours, and the effort that is required to achieve that goal of ours. So at every point in this journey is defined by where we are going, as Swami says, and what are we trying to do? What are we trying to accomplish? And what we're trying to do, is it in sync with what we are trying to achieve. So every moment, Swami says, is pregnant with all of these activities. And the ability to do what has to be done in that moment, what we refer to as living in that moment, that's all is meditation, right? That's all is being in that state of mindfulness. That is what we refer to as meditation. When we are sitting still with closed eyes, to be able to thoughtless is meditation. When you are doing an activity, to completely focus only on what needs to be done in that moment is what is referred to as meditation, right? When I say living in the moment, again, there's a question which always comes. I'll probably leave it for another occasion, what it means when Swami says live in the moment. It is not about being frivolous. You know, every temptation which comes, you embrace it. Every time, every object of pleasure which comes, you embrace it. That is not what is living in the moment. As Swami would say, any moment, any wakeful state is defined by karma, kala, karana and kartavya, which is what is the action that needs to be done at that moment, and what is the time frame, what is the scenario around, what is the paristhiti, as Swami would say, that defines that moment. And what is the cause, what, you know, where are you going, what is the purpose of what of that moment, and what we refer to as kartavya, that all of these define what is the duty of that moment. So every moment when I say I have to live in the now, I am talking about this now defined by these four aspects of karma, kala and karana and kartavya. And we are not able to do this because there are multiple focuses. There, I'm trying to reach a goal, but in the course of going towards that goal, there are many distractions which can give me intermediate happiness, intermediate joys, and so I get pulled by all of that. So Swami says meditation, any form of meditation, you refer to what we called as thumb meditation, right? Thumb meditation works because it improves your concentration. It gives you the ability to focus on what you're doing at that moment, right? That's what meditation is supposed to do. But now contrasting between what we were talking about, the two types of meditation, whether it is through these techniques such as thumb meditation or through the techniques such as yoga and dhyana and kundalini and all of those things, and the meditation which Swami refers to through the path of devotion. Swami says when you're talking about the other forms of meditation, yes, the result of all of that meditation is concentration. It gives you that idea of mindfulness. It gives you the ability to focus on what you're doing. And over a period of time when you do this, Swami says that it'll take you to the next level of what Swami refers to as contemplation. So that concentration is the first step. So all of these techniques will give you that concentration. But the problem is, Swami says, in these techniques of yoga and advanced form of meditation, Swami says, along with giving you the control of mind and giving you that concentration, Swami says, it also can give you superhuman abilities, what we refer to as siddhis, what we refer to as powers, right? So Swami says that is the pitfall with these techniques, where you get the benefit of meditation, which is concentration and one-pointedness, but along with that, you also get these abilities. And if your focus is not on the goal completely, which sometimes can happen, Swami says these becomes like very, very dangerous. And Swami would often refer to use a term called yoga bhrashta. When you're taken to the path of yoga and you make errors there, Swami says it's very, very dangerous. Now coming to the other, contrasting it with the other form of meditation that Swami speaks of, and this is again, I've mentioned it in that previous answer, whenever Swami speaks of meditation, Swami does not distinguish meditation from Namasmarana, right? Swami always speaks of Namasmarana, Japa and Dhyana as one unit, because that is what is the devotion-based meditation, right? The meditation technique is used, but the path is that of devotion. Swami says you start with Namasmarana. Namasmarana prepares your mind. Namasmarana is done out of love, right? You cannot take to Smarana unless you are attracted to a particular form. That's what Swami would say. That Smarana itself happens. You can casually hear about somebody. You can even speak their glory or sing their glory. But if left alone and you have to think of that person, you should really love that person, right? That is what is the idea of Namasmarana. So Swami says you start with Namasmarana. Whenever you get an opportunity, you sit down and you think of the Lord. You constantly think of His name, think of His form, think of His glory. Swami says you start with that Namasmarana. Because that is based on love, the reward that meditation, that form of meditation brings is also love. Any form of meditation will give you concentration. So even Namasmarana filled meditation will give you one pointed concentration. But in the earlier case, when we spoke about the other specialized form of meditation, Swami says, along with concentration, you get these powers. But in Namasmarana meditation, Swami says, along with concentration, the result is more and more love for God. Because it starts with love, the result will also be the purification of that love. You get more love for Swami. And Swami says, when this love is there, you know, when you start getting more and more love for Swami, Swami says that going to that next stage of contemplation is so very easy, right? When you talk about contemplation, you're referring to a state where you spontaneously think of God. You don't have to think, you don't have to sit down in a place, you don't have to have the environment around you to be calm, and only then I can do meditation. You are not in that state because it is based on love. You are very, very spontaneously thinking of that person. Every time you're given an opportunity, you'll think of that person. And Swami says that is the state of contemplation, where you do not have to sit down and concentrate to contemplate. Contemplation happens automatically. And that is what the Namasmarana-filled meditation can give you. It can give you one-pointedness, it can give you concentration, and it leads to the stage of contemplation so very effortlessly, right? And Swami also adds that apart from all of this, the reason why Namasmarana is very, very important and very effective is, Swami says, for this particular age of Kali Yuga, Namasmarana is got a little more, it's recommended. It works like a charm. It's much, much more effective than any other process. And that's one of the reasons why Swami did not encourage the other forms of meditation as much as Swami encouraged Namasmarana meditation. One thing is, we have that opportunity when God comes down in a human form. Swami would say that to students and devotees, I'm in front of you, meditate on my form. Swami would tell this to students. You don't have to do any meditation. Think of me, sit down, close your eyes and think of me from the tip of my head to the tip of my toe. There is no meditation greater than that. Or last week when we were speaking, a couple of weeks back we were speaking, Swami had taught some of the devotees the meditation of nothing but sitting and imagining Swami coming out for darshan from his residence to the bhajan hall. Swami said that is more than enough for meditation because it is based on love. It is based on this spontaneous bhakti. And the effect that can give is enormous. I had also promised I'll speak about Jyoti meditation, but I think maybe we'll have to leave that for some other occasion. But there is a very beautiful reason why Swami speaks of Jyoti meditation as very effective. Probably on some other context, we will speak about it. Sister Purnima Srinath, I hope what I've said was useful to you. Thank you very much for asking this question because it's something which all of us as devotees, this is an approach philosophy to Swami, if I could put it that way. And it's very important for us to get it clarified. And the beautiful thing is in Swami's Dhyana Vahini, which is meant to be a treatise on meditation, Swami speaks so much about Namasmarana and thinking of the name of the Lord and imagining the form of the Lord and developing love for Lord. Because there is no meditation technique which is more effective than that. You can meditate on other things. You can meditate on the thumb. Yes, it is not a technique which Swami has directly spoken. Swami might have guided him, Dr. Sola, personally, or it might have been a technique which works for him and so he is sharing it with all others, but I don't think Swami has personally spoken about that. So thank you very much, sister, for that question. If you have anything more to ask, feel free to write to me at prem@radiosai.org. All right, dear listeners, I'm already running out of time. Thank you for joining me. Do join us again next week. Next week is Swami's birthday, so let's see how it goes. It all depends on the timing of the program in the mandir. So if it does not work out, I'll meet you all the week after that. Thank you for tuning in. If you have a question you would like me to answer, feel free to write to me at prem@radiosai.org. That's my personal mail ID. The mails that you send to me will be read only by me. Confidentiality is guaranteed. If you don't want me to mention your name, please let me know. But if you could record your question in your own voice and send it across, I think that would be more than perfect. I could play it like how I did today. Once again, thank you, Sister Purnima, for that beautiful question. I hope we did justice to that. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. I'm going to leave you with a song, and at the other end of it, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu and his team for the Vahini Satsang. Thank you. Happy listening.
స్మరణం సాయి రూప ధ్యానం సాయి నామ స్మరణం సాయి రూప ధ్యానం సదా మాకు ఇగ పరాల నొసగు సాధనం సాయి నామ స్మరణం సాయి రూప ధ్యానం సదా మాకు ఇగ పరాల నొసగు సాధనం సాయి నామ స్మరణం సాయి రూప ధ్యానం సాయి నామ స్మరణం